This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Martin Garbist joins us to talk about environmental lawyer Stephen Donziger's day in court.
This is the most important environmental case in many, many years. Chevron polluted a piece of property in Ecuador the size of Rhode Island, killing and causing cancer to tens of thousands of people. And now they're not paying up on the judgment.
A recent report finds that the United States is guilty of crimes against humanity and other violations of international law.
This report demonstrates the international scandal of the number of people, half of whom are African Americans, who are killed by police every year in the United States of America.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Bogosian.
This is Jim Lafferty. I'm the director of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles, the host of the Lawyers Guild show on sister station KPFK in Los Angeles. And my commentary today is entitled, No Solitary Confinement for Chauvin. George Floyd's convicted murderer, Derek Chauvin, was taken from the courtroom directly to jail and put in solitary confinement, where he'll be at least until his sentencing, which is a couple of months away. And since there is a high level of concern that he would not survive in the general population of most prisons, he could well end up in solitary confinement during the entirety of his, hopefully, long prison term. But Derek Chauvin should not spend his imprisonment in solitary confinement, and neither should any other imprisoned human being. Now, once upon a time, it was only the seriously misbehaving prisoner who found themselves placed in solitary confinement, and then generally for only, a few hours or maybe a few days. And before 1990, so-called supermax prisons were very rare. But now, at least 44 states and the federal government have them. In these and many other prisons, prisoners are held in extreme isolation, sometimes for years or even decades. And it should surprise no one to learn that prison officials place a disproportionate number of prisoners of color, such as the Angola 3, into solitary confinement. Remember the Angola 3? Two of them, Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox, spent 40 years in solitary. The third, Robert King, spent 29 years. Eventually, all had their convictions overturned, by the way, for lack of evidence against them. Now, on any given day in America, there are more than 80,000 prisoners being held in solitary confinement or in isolation cells, or what is euphemistically called segregated housing. This amounts to the imposition of extremely cruel and unusual punishment, and those words really do not begin to fully describe what a horrific form of punishment it constitutes. Over 100 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court, addressing the effects of solitary confinement on prisoners, said, and I quote, "Prisoners subject to solitary confinement fell, after even a short confinement, into a semi-fatuous condition, from which it was next to impossible to arouse them, while others became violently insane, others still committed suicide, while those who stood the ordeal better were not generally reformed and in most cases did not recover sufficient mental activity to be of any subsequent service to the community," close quote. Now, this should surprise no one. While conditions in solitary can differ slightly from prison to prison, generally, people in solitary confinement or isolation cells spend 23 hours a day in them, alone. The 1 hour outside is generally spent with correction officers, or if lucky, an occasional family visit with the prisoner behind a glass partition to prevent any physical contact, or maybe a bit of time exercising, all with their cell consisting of nothing but a bunk, a sink, and a toilet, and little or nothing to read. They eat alone. They sleep alone. They spend 23 hours a day completely alone. What might surprise some is that these supermax prisons cost well, as much as three times to build and operate as traditional maximum security prisons. Given their profitability, though, for the corporations who build and often run them, it's not surprising they are proliferating in capitalist America. And making matters worse, numerous studies show supermax prisons actually have a negative impact on public safety. Of course, virtually all prisons in America impose shamefully inhumane conditions of incarceration on their inmates. But here is how one prisoner, Sarah Schrode, described her experience in solitary confinement. Quote, "My mind began to slip. I suffered from insomnia, nightmares, hallucinations, and emotional detachment, and often had violent attacks. More than once, I completely lost control and began screaming and beating at the walls of my cell until my knuckles bled. I started to realize there was a slow disintegration, really, of my personality, of my sense of who I was," close quote. America's epidemic of racist police killings is evidence of how uncivilized and inhumane America's policing has become. And locking away the perpetrators of those killings in solitary confinement would be further evidence of the same, further evidence of how unenlightened our entire criminal justice system has become. Derek Chauvin's conviction was an incredibly positive step in the long road that still lies before us if we are to finally end the epidemic of racist policing in America. Ironically, it can also be a big step in ending the barbaric practice of maintaining supermax prisons and throwing their inmates into solitary confinement in America. Because no one, including Derek Chauvin, deserves to be treated in such a primitive, such a barbaric manner, no matter what their crime or what their color. Maintaining such horrific gulags are a stain on our national character. Let us seize this moment to shine a bright light on the horror of solitary confinement and use every arrow in our quiver, including opposing solitary confinement for Derek Chauvin, in our fight to finally end this barbaric and primitive form of imprisonment.
May 11th marks the 5th anniversary of Michael Ratner's death. May 1st, his memoir, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, was published by Orr Books. Michael was one of the people that started Law and Disorder, along with me, Heidi Boghossian, and Dahlia Hashad. We started it on WBAI in New York City, and it's now on 120 other stations around the country. Michael wanted it to continue after his death, and we've grown from coast to coast and around the world. Michael is known as the great human rights lawyer of his generation. He handled a number of extremely important cases. He had a sign over his desk at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he was the president, and the sign read, "Four key principles of being a radical lawyer. 1. Do not refuse to take a case just because it has a long odds of winning in court. 2. Use cases to publicize a radical critique of U.S. policy and to promote revolutionary transformation. 3. Combine legal work with political advocacy. And 4. Love people." The last case that Michael handled until the day he died was the case of Julian Assange. It's the most important civil liberties case that we have in America today. If the government is successful in convicting Julian Assange, who's a journalist and a publisher, charged him with 17 counts of espionage, if they're successful in extraditing him from England, where he now sits in solitary confinement in Belmarsh Prison, if they can bring him back here to the Eastern District of Virginia and convict him, he faces 175 years in a maxi-max prison. The conviction will mark the end of free journalism. Michael's book, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, opens up with a thrilling chapter on how Michael went to London, met Julian, and agreed to represent him. You can get the book, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, from orbooks.com. That's orbooks.com. And you'll see when you get it a picture of Michael Ratner standing in front of the Supreme Court, and on top of the cover, there's a quote from Amy Goodman. Driven by love and compassion, Michael Ratner was the most tenacious and brilliant of lawyers. I wrote the introduction to the book, and I want to conclude by reading the last paragraph. Michael will be remembered as a generous, loyal friend and a gentle and kind person. He was a compelling speaker, an acute observer of the political scene, and a far-sighted visionary. Professionally, Michael will live on as one of the great advocates for justice of his time. Thanks are due to Zach Sklar, who so ably picked up the baton when Michael became too ill to complete the book and fashioned it into a finished work of which Michael would have been proud. Michael Ratner, presente.
Sixty-year-old environmental lawyer Stephen Donziger has been under house arrest without trial for the last 25 months on charges that normally carry a maximum sentence of 6. To date, this is the longest sentence imposed in New York on an attorney convicted of contempt. The charges stem from Donziger's refusal to turn over his cell phone and computer to the court. We've been covering Chevron's retaliation campaign against Donziger after he helped communities in Ecuador's Amazon win a historic $9.5 billion judgment against the oil giant. His case showed how Chevron deliberately dumped billions of gallons of carcinogenic oil water onto indigenous ancestral lands. In response to the multi-billion-dollar judgment, Chevron launched a retaliation campaign against the human rights lawyer. The multinational corporation enlisted 60 law firms and 2,000 attorneys to block Donziger's advocacy. In the process, they bankrupted his family and intimidated environmentalist activists and allies around the globe. Finally, Stephen's trial is set to begin on Monday, May 10th. The case offers a play-by-play account of a private oil company intent on destroying an altruistic lawyer, environmental justice, corporate accountability, indigenous rights, and free speech. Joining us today with an update on trial preparations and what's at stake is noted First Amendment lawyer Martin Garbus. Martin is a member of the Donziger legal defense team. Martin, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, as this show airs in New York City, literally in 1 hour, Steve Donziger faces trial in federal court on a misdemeanor contempt charge that's resulted in him enduring over 600 days of house arrest. What do you think will happen today?
I think we'll do the opening. We'll start the case. At the end of the day, he will be convicted. He is totally innocent. And in my opening to the court, I will say, after I go through the routine of denying the charges, that I know very well that he's going to be convicted, and that all that I look upon this case as doing is laying a predicate for an appeal. And I've never said that in the courtroom before, and I have no idea how Judge Preska will react to my fundamentally calling her a biased judge.
Have you ever seen this kind of punishment for a misdemeanor before?
It's absolutely extraordinary. What we learned, by the way, there was a Wall Street Journal article this Monday, and with the Wall Street Journal was the front page. It was about this case. It went on for a full page inside. And what that Wall Street Journal article told us was that in 2010, Chevron went to the prosecutors in the U.S. Attorney's Office to try and get a prosecution started. 2010, this is before the Kaplan decisions that we'll talk about. 11 years ago, Chevron started dealing with the U.S. government to try and get a prosecution started. Then they went to Berman, who was then the U.S. attorney. He refused to start a prosecution. Judge Kaplan asked Berman to start a prosecution. He refused to start a prosecution. Ultimately, Kaplan starts a prosecution. So one of the questions we're going to explore fully is what happens in that period of time from 2010 to a year ago when the prosecution has started, what kind of pressure did Chevron put on the prosecutor's office? How many times did the prosecutor say no? What, if any, was Rudy Giuliani's role in this, who has always been a very successful lawyer for the oil and gas industry? He had a law firm which was named as one of the top lobbyists for the oil and gas business. And you remember Berman, the U.S. attorney, who has refused to prosecute this case, was fired by Barr because Berman indicated he might prosecute Giuliani. Now, that's a lot, I think, to give you. We can break it down if you want.
Let's veer just a little bit off that specific topic, because as we're taping this show, six members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus just sent an urgent letter to U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland urging that the Department of Justice reassert jurisdiction over and review Stevens' case. Do you expect a response?
No. I think that the case has gone too far at this point. In other words, there may be a response later on, but it's not going to stop the trial from going ahead. I think Garland has too much on his plate. I think that the progressive members of the House who have asked for an investigation, I think they're correct, but the trial is now starting, and I don't think anything is going to happen in the next 10 days. I could be wrong. I'd like to be wrong, but I don't think I'm wrong.
Attorney Marty Garbus, despite international media coverage, support from 55 Nobel laureates and hundreds of prominent lawyers demanding justice for Stephen, the courts are showing no sign of letting up in their highly unusual treatment of him. What's your response to that inaction?
Well, I think that Chevron has extraordinary economic power. I think that Chevron has spent, according to the Wall Street Journal, and we know it to be true, many millions of dollars in trying to defeat Donziger. One of the dangers of this entire proceeding is one loses sight of what's really going on. In other words, the larger case is really not about Donziger. The larger case is what oil companies, Chevron, did in, let's say, developing countries. We used to call them third world countries. Now they're developing countries. So I think that the criminal case we're faced with is Donziger's activity on behalf of these injured and killed Ecuadorians. But the larger case is less Donziger and more the horrors that were perpetrated by Chevron. Now, of course, Chevron is using Donziger as a whipping boy, trying to make sure that no other lawyer is going to come in and challenge them again. And Chevron has a program, it's called the Killers Program, which is done by Gibson and Dunn. And what it does is they locate cases like this, they locate lawyers like Donziger, and then the specific words in the Killers Program is, we will ultimately wind up charging these lawyers with fraud, etc. It's an attempt to discourage courageous lawyers like Donziger from ever getting close to a case like this again. So the case has many different contexts.
You mentioned the amount of money Chevron has spent on this. They've hired a lot of attorneys. How many attorneys have they retained over the years?
Chevron? I think the Wall Street Journal gives it a number of about 250. We're going to find, let me tell you how this criminal prosecution works. The U.S. attorney refused to prosecute. Kaplan then appoints a private law firm. The private law firm is one that wants to be successful in the oil and gas industry. They are getting into this business knowing it is their foothold into the oil and gas industry. They have thus far run up bills of $500,000. They have reduced their bills by 50%. So it's really $1 million worth of time. Chevron's lawyers, Gibson Dunn, have put in $1 million thus far. So it's a $2 million Chevron prosecution in order against a man for a petty offense, a serious traffic ticket. And he's been under house arrest, as you pointed out, for an extraordinary length of time, subject to waves and waves of lawyers going at him, solely to obscure from view the fact that Chevron committed one of the worst environmental disasters in the world. So the tragedy here is Chevron's trying to hide what they did by turning this into a Danziger prosecution.
Marty, tell us about Steve Danziger's defense team.
Right now, it's Ron Kuby and his colleague, and then Aaron, who himself is under criminal contempt, civil contempt charges. He worked with Steve, and he may wind up being sued both civilly and criminally in the same way that Steve was, and I'm there. And there are a host of other people. There are a lot of law students who are involved in this. Professor Charlie Nesson of Harvard, an extraordinary scholar, has been involved in this. Other professors at Harvard have also contributed. A wonderful law student named Matt Burton is involved in the case. It's a group, pro bono. The amount of resources that we have in the courtroom as compared to what Chevron can do with respect to witnesses, preparation, exhibits, I mean, we are really at a bare bones level. And as we all know, you both know from your years of experience, that's a significant factor in a courtroom.
Martin, I want to go back for a second to what you were saying about Chevron wanting to hide, distract, take attention away from their violations. Congressman Jim McGovern said that Chevron walked away after polluting an area of Ecuador that was the size of the state of Rhode Island, and that Stephen exposed the truth of that. In the big picture, we see how zealously Chevron is fighting to have this truth come out. But what did that historic $9.5 billion judgment against Chevron in 2013 represent for environmental justice?
I think it was an extraordinary thing. I mean, Steve Danziger went down there, spent a good deal of time there, and you have what is again called a developing country. It's no surprise to us that their skins are not the same color as white. And ultimately, you have this Ecuadorian court go through the case again and again and again, and then Danziger comes to the United States to try and enforce the judgment, and a judge refuses to enforce the judgment. The judge refuses the views of Ecuadorian court after Ecuadorian court up and down the appellate ladder, which wind up with the result that Danziger was seeking to enforce. I don't think any judge has ever totally rejected a legal system the way Kaplan has, and I'm absolutely sure that if the legal system of Germany, England, France, it would never have been rejected.
Marty, how unusual is it for Judge Kaplan to get a private law firm to go after Danziger after the Department of Justice refused to do it?
We have never seen a case like that in American history. We have looked as far as we can into what is called Rule 42, and there has never been a case anything like this where a judge goes and then a prosecution team is formed, paid for by an outside party, Chevron, who is a litigant with Danziger. It is beyond comprehension. Rule 42 permits a judge to select another judge for a case. It has to be done basically through the wheel. He goes to the court administrator and he tells the court administrator to pick another judge on the wheel. Kaplan didn't do that. Kaplan has the power to ignore the wheel in rare cases, and he has the power then to say, I'm going to appoint X judge. But he doesn't have unbridled power to appoint the judge. The fact that the present judge is a member of the Federalist Society, that she was honored by the Federalist Society, that Chevron and Gibson and Dunn make a large contribution to the Federalist Society. When Kaplan made a choice to pick this judge out of 30 or 40 other judges in the Southern District, including judges like Judge Rakoff, Judge Berman, he's making a conscious decision about where he wants the case to go. I cannot believe that any other Southern District judge would have put Donziger under house arrest for 2 years and would have permitted this kind of prosecution. So his selection of this judge, which we are dealing with in the case, we just filed some documents today saying that he cannot just arbitrarily pick a judge who he thinks will lead to a certain result. We're long past the time, and certainly your viewers are long past the time, when, as Judge Roberts said, all judges do is call balls and strikes. We know that's nonsense. And we know that the kind of justice you get is from the kind of judge you get. So here you have a deliberate decision by Kaplan not to go through the random process and then to pick out this particular judge. It has never before been done in American history.
Weren't there conflicts of interest specifically with attorney Rita Glavin, who had a link to Chevron?
Rita Glavin, the law firm, Rita Glavin Seward, previously had done work for Chevron. Not $30,000. That should have disqualified them alone. But the $30,000 is minuscule. The amount of money that Seward will make from this entry into the oil and gas prosecution of Donziger types is very substantial. The amount of money that they will make in this case, let's assume it's $1 million at the end of the day, or $1.5 million. They're also writing off about $1.5 million because they took it at reduced rates. Now, they didn't do that, as I said, because they're the Red Cross. We all know how law firms work. We all know what motivates you. The same motivations that you have in private practice earning fees should be different than the motivations U.S. attorneys have as they prosecute criminal cases.
What's at the crux of this corporate-sponsored prosecution? In what way does Chevron contend that Stephen is breaking the law?
Well, they're contending he refused to follow certain orders from Judge Kaplan. One of those orders was Judge Kaplan wanted him to turn over confidential documents that he had from his clients and people he dealt with in the preparation of the case in his computer. He refused to do it. He refused to endanger his clients and those who support him by turning over that information. That's one of the charges. There are six. I could go down them piece by piece, but they're all similar. They're all framed charges in that they have never been made before anywhere in a prosecution like this before a judge like this. The indecency of this case has been obscured by the relentless attack on Donziger. They kept trying to keep the focus on what Donziger did and how he tried to put this case together and what he did, obscuring what's going on in the prosecution and trying to obscure what Chevron did in Ecuador.
Marty, we just have a few minutes remaining. How is Stephen holding up through all this?
I think it's difficult. He has a wife. He has a child. It's havoc with your personal life to be confined. I mean, of course, the MCC is worse, but still to be confined. But not only that, they've also had him disbarred, and they've also basically taken every penny he's had by the Kaplan decision. So this is a man who's basically been fighting alone. He's had a lot of lawyers helping him, but it's basically a lot of it has been pro bono representation. so people come and go, and sometimes pro bono representation matched against Chevron tens of millions of dollars is just inadequate. We're now raising issues that should have been raised years ago in his case. He did not have constitutional lawyers with him in the beginning, and I believe if he did have, there never would have been this judgment even rendered. But that it's too late for that. That's past. And we have to deal with what's now. He's a lawyer who's been confined, and out of his confinement, he's trying to raise money for the case and trying to get facts to help the case. I mean, he's a very, very resolute, determined, committed lawyer.
Marty, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately, but I wanted to ask you, how can listeners follow this case? How can they show support? I expect that people will be coming down to the courthouse Monday at 10 o'clock to show support. Perhaps even Stephen's going to be speaking. But in any case, can you tell us what people can do to try to help out?
Well, they can basically send money, not for me and not for his other lawyers, but we were trying to get witnesses to come in from Ecuador. Court costs are very substantial. Transcripts, this, that, and the other things. And keeping Gonziger alive, he has no income at all. They have cut off every source of his income. He's running a constant site saying, you know, for contributions, $25 or even more. But that's what he needs desperately now. What he also needs is the focus back on the Ecuadorians and people coming to, we would hope to have many people coming to the courthouse. It's 500 Pearl Street in Lower Manhattan, the new federal court building. It starts an hour after it starts at 10 o'clock Monday morning, and we'll go from day to day.
Is there a website that you can share with us?
So Donziger's website is donzigersdefense.com. It has running information about the case, about the case, the issues that are being filed, and seeks funds. He's basically been without an income now, I can't, perhaps 10 years. And he basically has put together these coalitions that are representing him in a variety of cases throughout. So funds are very important for him. Support is very important for him. The, you know, getting the House progressives to come in on his behalf was important. The on Donziger's site, you'll see the names of the people, AOC, Raskin. They should be, you know, your listeners should write to them or email to them and encourage their support. In other words, they've now come out and asked for an investigation, but it's going to take time and it's going to take energy. And these congressmen have to be kept in the fight. Donziger, it's unlikely that he's going to win in a court of law. I hate to say that as his lawyer, but it's unlikely unless he gets an enormous amount of support and unless the people in the House really do persuade Merrick Garland to intervene.
Well, we have our mission to encourage everyone to either rally around the courthouse, donate to Stephen's effort, and spread the word about this multi-unjust case. Martin, we have to say goodbye, but we'll stay in touch and we'll cover the case as it unfolds.
Thank you very, very much, both of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin Garvis, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As issues of violent policing nag at the American public's conscience, a new report finds the U.S. guilty of crimes against humanity and other violations of international law. On April 27, the International Commission of Inquiry on Systemic Racist Police Violence in the U.S. released its final report. It pulls together weeks of live hearings chronicling cases of people of African descent by police. The report also contains recommendations addressed to national and international policymakers. The International Commission of Inquiry was organized by the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, and the National Lawyers Guild, a distinguished panel of international legal experts from 11 countries served as its commissioners. The full 188-page document is available at the Commission's website, as are videos and transcripts from the live hearings in 44 cases. Joining us today is panel member Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught from 1991 to 2016, and she is also a former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She lectures, writes, and provides commentary for local, regional, national, and international media outlets. Marjorie has also served as a news consultant for CBS News and a legal analyst for Court TV, as well as a legal and political commentator on BBC, CNN, NPR, and other major stations. Marjorie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Heidi and Michael.
Talk briefly, please, about the formation and also the purpose of the Commission of Inquiry on Systematic Racial Police Violence.
Well, the commission was established in the wake of the public torture and execution of George Floyd after millions of people saw the video and took to the streets. And the families of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Michael Brown, and Philando Castile joined 600 rights groups and petitioned the UN Human Rights Council to appoint a commission of inquiry to investigate systemic racist police violence against people of African descent in the United States. But after succumbing to enormous pressure by the Trump administration and U.S. allies, the Human Rights Council instead directed the High Commissioner of Human Rights to prepare a report, but not limited to the United States. In other words, systemic racism and violations of human rights by police against Africans and people of African descent throughout the world. So, as a result, three organizations, the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, and the National Lawyers Guild, created this commission of inquiry to examine systemic racist police violence against people of African descent in the United States. And the 12 commissioners, who are judges, lawyers, professors, and experts from Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe, and the Caribbean, held public hearings from January 18th to February 6th, and they held hearings in 44 different cases. 43 of them resulted in the deaths of African Americans. One resulted in the paralyzing of Jacob Blake. And in addition to the hearings and extensive research, they made certain findings in this report. And I should say that all of the cases selected for the hearings involved the killing of unarmed individuals or people who posed no threat to the police officers or others.
Attorney Marjorie Cohn, after hearing the testimony and reviewing national data, what did the commissioners conclude? Please give us a summary answer of that conclusion.
Well, the commissioners determined that the problem is not just a few bad apples. The problem is structural racism and systemic racist police violence that dates back to history, in the context of a history of oppression dating back to the extermination of First Nations peoples, the enslavement of Africans, the militarization of U.S. society, and the continued perpetuation of structural racism. And so specifically, the commissioners found that pretextual traffic stops are a common precursor to police killings and uses of excessive force against African Americans, that race-based street stops known as stop and frisk often trigger the use of deadly force by police, that Fourth Amendment violations invariably lead to excessive force and police killings of black people, that police routinely use excessive and lethal restraints against black people, including tasers, chokeholds, compression asphyxia, rough rides, and the use of vehicles as deadly weapons, that lethal police violence against black people is exacerbated by the officers' failure to provide medical attention, that lethal police violence against black people experiencing mental health crises is systematic, that cis and transgender black women, girls, and femmes are disproportionately killed by police, that systemic racist police violence kills and traumatizes black children and youth and devastates and traumatizes families and communities, that black immigrants are particularly vulnerable to systemic racist police violence and police killings, and that legal actors are complicit in police violence and killings of black people through qualified immunity and systemic impunity of officers. Officers are rarely held accountable. Derek Chauvin's convictions are exceptional, and only because that video went viral and people demanded accountability around the world, really. And also an alarming pattern of destruction and manipulation of evidence, cover up and obstruction of justice, where prosecutors have a conflict of interest because the police are their investigative arm, so they don't like to prosecute police. Medical examiners are often complicit doing the bidding of police. And prosecutorial misconduct and grand jury abuse is another finding of the commissioners, where officers, for example, officers testified at the grand juries in the killings of both Michael Brown and Tamir Rice, and in neither case was the officer cross-examined. There were no indictments in either case. Also, the commissioners found systemic impunity and lack of oversight by the police. The police cannot be trusted to police themselves, and these so-called internal affairs investigations invariably exonerate the officers. The blue wall of silence, also known as the thin blue line, keeps officers from reporting misconduct by fellow officers. In the Chauvin case, we saw three officers aiding and abetting Derek Chauvin. And then police unions facilitate the impunity of officers. The police union got the body camera footage a few days after the killing of Daniel Prude, who was killed while experiencing a mental health crisis, but it took the Prude family 6 months to get the body camera footage, and only after they filed several lawsuits. And finally, qualified immunity, which exonerates police, actually operates as absolute immunity and poses an extraordinary obstacle to families who are trying to hold the officers accountable. The commissioners also found violations of human rights, the right to life, the right to liberty and security, the right to mental health, the right to be free from arbitrary detention, and the right to be free from torture and cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. And one of the most striking conclusions of the commissioners in this report is the finding that the systematic police killings of black people in the United States constitutes a prima facie case of crimes against humanity. And they asked the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court to investigate this. The crimes under the Rome Statute for the court include murder, severe deprivation of physical liberty, torture, persecution of people of African descent, and inhumane acts causing great suffering or serious injury to body or mental or physical health. And all of those crimes occurred in the context of a widespread or systematic attack directed against the civilian population of black people in the United States, as documented by the findings of fact in the 188-page report.
Wow, Marjorie, this is incredible. I couldn't help but think when we three were in law school taking criminal procedure, a report like this would have changed the curriculum and how they teach Crim Pro. We don't have time to go into each of these findings, but Michael and I were interested especially with the traffic stop and use of force against unarmed people of African descent during traffic and investigatory stops. Can you just briefly talk about that? How did we get to a place where stopping African Americans driving has become often a deadly encounter?
Well, Heidi, the Supreme Court, unfortunately, has sanctioned racial profiling, particularly in traffic stops, in the 1989 case of Wren versus United States, which was written by Justice Scalia, and I use the word justice advisedly, but also it was a unanimous decision where the Supreme Court ruled that if there is a probable cause of a traffic violation, even if it's an expired tag or a child throwing candy out the window, which were two of the cases that we looked at, that it was okay to stop the car even if the officer was motivated by racism. And so we have the doctrine in this Wren case called pretext stops, which are now lawful thanks to the Supreme Court. And the finding of fact that the commissioners made was that these pretextual traffic stops are a common precursor to police killings and uses of excessive force against people of African descent. One of our cases, the killing of Tavis Crane, he was killed by police after his young daughter threw a piece of candy out the window, and they came and killed him. And this is unfortunate. A number of our cases involved very similar situations. And we're seeing that today continually. I mean, this is not just a one-off. From March 29th, the day the trial of Derek Chauvin for killing George Floyd began, through April 18th, at least 64 people in the United States died at the hands of law enforcement, and more than half of the victims were black or brown.
So, Attorney Marjorie Cohn, what does the report call for in terms of reforms? Does this pattern and practice amount to crimes against humanity?
Yes, it does, and that is why the commissioners asked the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court to launch an investigation. Now, keep in mind that the United States is not a party to the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court, and one of the recommendations of the commissioners is that the U.S. join the Rome Statute, sign and ratify the Rome Statute. But in the meantime, there is a provision in the Rome Statute that even a country that isn't a party to the statute can accept jurisdiction of the court in a specific instance, such as this one, investigating crimes against humanity. The commissioners directed their recommendations to the UN High Commissioner, the Human Rights Council, the International Criminal Court, but also to the executive branch of the United States government, and called on the United States government to institute a number of reforms, but also to support the BREATHE Act, which is aimed at divesting federal resources from policing and instead coming up with new non-punitive approaches to community safety. Also, eliminating qualified immunity and bringing the standards for policing in line with international standards, and supporting legislation to demilitarize policing, because the Pentagon gives the police departments military equipment under the 1033 program, and so we have really the police in this country as an occupying armed force, very much like the military. And so there are a number of other recommendations in the report, and I direct people to the Inquiry Commission. If you put in Inquiry Commission, you should come up with this, the commission's website and the report, also the hearings, both transcripts and live hearings, video hearings, in these 44 cases. Many of these victims people have heard of, some they have not heard of, and the testimony from family members of the victims, attorneys, community activists, and experts are really compelling.
This is really an enlightening report and so critically important and needed right now. Just a quick question on the issue of demilitarizing domestic law enforcement. Would that call include adhering to international standards for use of lethal force?
Yes, absolutely. Under international standards that the U.S. is bound by, the law enforcement officials have to use less lethal, nonviolent means before resorting to force, and only when it's when there is an immediate threat of death or great bodily injury. And unfortunately, this there is no state in the country that requires that. So no state in the U.S. complies with that international standard, and that is certainly part of the recommendations of the commissioners in this report.
Any parting words on this, Marjorie? We're so thrilled with this result and the hard work that went into it over these last few months.
Well, we are hopeful, and by the way, my involvement in this commission is as one of four rapporteurs who helped draft the report, and our hope is that activists and organizers, as well as the executive branch, the congressional branch, and international organizations and entities, will use this report and take these findings and use it for organizing, for litigation, for research. So there is a lot to mine in the report, and there is a four-page annotated table of contents. When you click on a certain heading or subheading, it'll take you right to that part of the report. So our hope is that this report will be useful, and unfortunately we're going to see a proliferation and continuation of systemic racist police violence against black people in this country, which is going to make this report relevant on an ongoing basis.
Marjorie, kudos to you and the entire commission for this essential primer that we hope will move the public and our officials to action.
Thank you so much, Heidi and Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Bye.